Okay, so last time we were, before we had Dr. Mike Foley's presentation, we were talking about HTTP, and we're talking about persistent connections, remember, and we talked about that. We talked about stateless protocol. We talked about how it was a ASCII text-based protocol. You could just telnet to a web server and get it to React. This time, first of all, let's do this. At the point where we stopped, we were about to talk about cookies and what cookies are all about. You'll remember that when we first talked about HTTP, we said it was a stateless protocol. That meant that the server didn't remember anything about the client from one interaction to the next. And that, as we observed, makes it hard to do things like shopping carts and the like. So somebody came up with the idea of cookies. So what is a cookie, first of all? It's a little bit of text. That's all it is. And it gets stored in the client machine by the server sending a header line saying, here's a cookie. Right? That's basically what it amounts to, is that the server sends a cookie header with the little bit of text in it that gets stored in the client machine, and then later when the client comes back to that website, it says, oh, I have a cookie for that website, associated with that website, and I should send it along with my request. That's all it is. And out of that little bit of additional technology, the servers are able to actually create state in the client that's persistent, and then if sort of outside of the HTTP processing, they also retain information that they look up when a client connects. They can associate those two things and thereby figure out what they already know about the client. So let's look at how that works. Easier to see here. So the client has in its local storage a cookie already for eBay, but it's making now a request to Amazon. It doesn't send the eBay cookie along, right? Easy enough. The Amazon server replies with a set cookie header that now gets stored in the client. And subsequently, when the client makes a request of the server, it sends along the Amazon cookie for the Amazon server and gets back a response. And the thing is that when it gets this one over here, Amazon can look up that 1678 and say, what does that mean to me? Right? It's entirely up to the server how that gets interpreted. Okay. And so you can come back sometime later and get this. So there's a lot of there's some variation on the technology associated with cookies. You can have so-called persistent cookies that last from one instantiation of the browser to the next, and you can have more transitory cookies that will disappear when the browser is closed. Okay, so there's some variation on that, but the idea is the same. We're using this little bit of data passed back and forth to maintain state across different HTTP connections. Okay, so cookies are sometimes considered a bit dangerous because dangerous to privacy anyway, because various browser hacks have been determined that let sites actually get their hands on cookies that aren't theirs. That's kind of nasty. Then you find out what other sites a person might have been visiting. And of course, a site can always use cookies or attempt to use cookies to track its own interactions with you. And that's, some people don't like that. So, on the other hand, it enables a whole lot of stuff that is useful. And so, it sort of illustrates this tension between usefulness and sense of security that often crops up in networking and distributed computing. And there's no easy way to resolve that tension, I would say. That if you want some of these benefits with a protocol like HTTP, at least, you're going to have to be revealing information. You're going to be revealing information to websites, and they're going to remember it. And there's not much that can be done about that, and you sort of have to do that. So, anyway. Second thing to talk about. So the things we're going to talk about today are the cookies. We're going to talk about caching and its use in the web protocols. We're going to talk about email, and we're going to talk about DNS. And so we've got to move right along. All right. So caching. How many people took 260? How many people took 214? Some people didn't take either one yet. 214? EE 214? Yeah. Okay. So when you took EE 214, did you talk about caching at all? Probably not. Okay. So we cover that in 260, but not 214. So here's the idea. Generally speaking, what is caching about? Find a spot to write here. Caching. Keep a copy of information close to where it will be used. So you can get it fast. All right. So, for the web, what this means is if I've already gone out and gotten a page, and I come back to that page, it will be faster if I've kept a copy than if I have to go fetch it again. All right? That's the basic idea of caching. And the relevant metrics are the time to fetch the uncached version. Uncached copy. The time to fetch the cached copy and the hit rate. Fraction of requests found in the cache. All right. So if I have a cache and I make a request, then sometimes I'll find what I'm looking for in the cache and sometimes I won't. Right? And what you want to know about a cache is how much good does it do you. So let's go on to the next page. This is just explaining how a proxy server works. Instead of making the request directly to the website, you maybe have a intermediate server that does the caching. It's called a proxy server. A proxy server lets a lot of different clients share the same cache. Okay? And that's good because potentially a lot of different clients are fetching the same pages and they can all benefit from the cache. But what I really want to get to is some blank space. Okay, so what we're interested then in is the average access time equals, what do you think? It's the hit rate times the time to fetch from cache plus 1 minus the hit rate times the time to fetch from home. That is wherever it lives in the device. Now this is general for caches of any kind. So memory caches, disk caches, whatever kind of cache you're talking about, this formula describes the performance achieved by using the cache, right? That's a general notion that you need to know in computer science because it applies across so many different things. So the example that we have here in the slides is slightly different from the one in the book. They just moved a decimal point, basically, in going from this one to the one that's in the book. Here we're talking about requests fetching 100,000 bits on a 10 megabit per second LAN. They sort of boosted it up for the book. The book is a little newer than the slides, and we have 100 megabits per second LAN. Anyway, so the idea of this example is to show what benefit a cache can give when the cache is implemented at an institutional level. So we're going to assume that the cache is sort of here serving all of these different clients. And the scenario that they've described is one that says, when I make a web request, it takes 2 seconds to get a response over the internet. They've called that the internet delay. And basically that takes into account everything that happens from the time the request is sent on the internet until when it comes back out here. In addition, they're concerned about the delays on the access link between the institution and the internet, which is given a speed that's only about a sixth of the speed of the LAN. And then, of course, and we'll talk about this later when we talk about link layers, there's potentially some delay associated with putting a request on the LAN. Turns out that time to put a request on the LAN is just a few milliseconds would be a typical number. The internet delay is, like I said, 2 seconds, and then how long does it take to get across this link? Well, they've chosen numbers here so that this link is fully loaded. What did we say last time about queuing delay on fully loaded links? It grows without bound, right? So the delay here could be many, many seconds. Probably, I mean, they've said minutes here, but if it's really minutes, the browsers are going to sort of give up and you'll say the internet is broken, would be the conclusion. So, can we fix this with a cache? So, well, before we fix it with a cache, one thing we could do is make the access link itself much faster. Okay? Then there wouldn't be any queuing delay associated with it at the load that we've postulated. But that would be a costly solution. 10 megabits per second link is even in this day and age, fairly expensive. So the other alternative is to insert a cache here and make the browsers direct their requests to the cache. If the cache has it, it responds. If it doesn't, then the cache itself goes out over the internet and fetches the pages. So again, sort of making up numbers, suppose that 40% of the requests are satisfied by the cache, so that's the hit rate. This is the number that aren't satisfied is called the miss rate. And of course, the hit rate is 1 minus the missed rate, and vice versa. Now, this link will only be 60% utilized, because before it was 100% utilized, and now we've taken away 40% of the requests. A 60% utilized link will have minimal queuing delays, and so the average access time goes down to something like 1.2 seconds, 1.2 to 1.4 seconds. Just doing back of the envelope calculations, and we no longer have browsers timing out, and we no longer say the web is broken. In actual implementation of institutional networks, caches come and go in popularity. Part of the problem these days is that the web just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and people's interests keep getting broader and broader, so it becomes harder and harder to cache a significant part of the pages that people are actually going to be looking at, especially when you think of things like streaming video, voice over IP, and other things that will be using this link. You have to go through some analysis to determine whether a cache will actually be beneficial. If you can't achieve a significant hit rate, then it's not going to help much. Yeah, Kelly.
So, is there some mechanism for cache determining
when a
website is out of date?
Yes. We're going to look at that here in just a second. Back on the very next slide. So, in order to determine whether a page, actually we're concerned with individual pages, to determine whether a page is out of date, we can actually ask the server to fetch a page only if it has been modified since a given date. Okay, and if it hasn't, then the response just says not modified, and the cache knows that it can deliver up the version that it has. If it has been modified, of course, you get back a normal response. Okay. Another request that goes along these lines is the head request that can similarly get information about a page without actually fetching the page. So that's important to make caching work. Okay, any questions about the remainder of HTTP? Simple, really simple idea with some subtleties along the way. And take a look at the book, read through it, and I think you'll get it. It's pretty straightforward. Second thing to talk about today is email. And everybody's used email, of course. The thing that I hope you get out of today's discussion of email is some sense of what your mail client program is doing, Outlook or Thunderbird or whatever it is that you use to read email, versus what's going on in the background, sort of out there in the internet to make all that work. So the thing that you use is called a user agent. whatever it is. You know, it's the thing that presents the list of email. It fetches it from the mail server for you, lets you write email, and all that stuff. The user agents interact with entities called mail servers, and those are the things in the background. So we'll talk about how they work. And the protocol that they use for sending mail is called Simple Message Transport Protocol, SMTP. Okay? And it turns out that SMTP is not only used between the mail servers, but also by the user agents for sending mail, or a lot of user agents. They don't have to, but a lot do. Okay. Well, let's start here. What happens when you send mail? Your user agent talks to some mail server. Let's pick one. Talks to some mail. Talks to some mail server using SMTP to put the outgoing message in its outgoing message queue. That's the green thing here. The green things are the outgoing message queues. The mail server figures out where that message needs to be sent to and sends it to another mail server. Okay? So the mail server takes it out of its mail queue and sends it to another mail server using SMTP. And that other mail server, if it's the actual destination for the mail, will put it in a mailbox for the particular user. Okay? So mailboxes are where messages go on the mail server when they're about to be delivered. The message queue is where they go when they need to be delivered to another mail server. Now the slides here, I don't know about the book. The slides talk as if the mail servers always send mail to the ultimate destination mail server. That doesn't have to be the case. The email message can actually bounce through many different mail servers between the time that it is first sent and when it is ultimately received. And it's illustrative to take a look at what you get when you, say, view the source of a email message in Thunderbird or Outlook. All the clients I know of will let you actually see what the full text was of the message with all the headers and stuff. And what you'll see in there is a bunch of headers that say received from, received from, received from, received from. And each one of those is a hop between mail servers that has occurred in the history of this message. Right? And so if you look at your messages, if you correspond with folks from distant locations or other universities, what you're going to see is that the mail has actually gone through many mail servers between the point where it was first sent and when it was delivered to your mailbox. So I encourage you to do that. I think it's a useful exercise. What else did I want to say that? Oh, okay. So mailboxes can be stored on the server in a lot of different formats. There actually aren't any required standards about how mail servers store messages in mailboxes, although there are sort of voluntary standards that encourage certain other kinds of interoperability when they're used. But for example, the Outlook mail server or the Exchange mail server doesn't use those because the way that clients interact with come back to that. Gee, thanks. The way that the clients interact with the mailboxes is using defined protocols. So the mailbox doesn't have to be in a particular format because the client is going to interact with it through a protocol. And so the server gets to store the message however it wants as long as it can obey the protocol. So the common protocols for mail retrieval, so these are mail retrieval rather than sending, are so-called POP, which is the pretty much the oldest way of doing it that's a defined protocol. Later came IMAP, and we'll talk about why they're different. And then these days, there are HTTP mail retrieval schemes such as Gmail and Hotmail and Yahoo Mail that really are not standardized, I would say, right? They are just, you're using HTTP to display a website and it's a web page, and it so happens that web page in fact shows you your email, right? So there's no standardization about that. These are the standard ways of doing it these days. Yeah, Chuck.
How is it that POP has a higher RFC number?
Probably because this is a revision of the original. Yeah, and there may be a revision of this one now too. Yep. So, POP3 protocol. This is really version 3 of Post Office Protocol. Again, it's a text-based protocol. You can telnet to a mail server and go through this just by typing commands at the prompts. The server greets you when you first make the connection. The client sends a user command and a password command in order to log in during the authorization phase. And then there are a bunch of other commands that you can use, such as list to see what's in the mailbox on the server, retrieve messages, and delete messages. So one thing that you may have noticed in configuring your email clients is that you're given, if you go to the options for a particular server, you're given the option of deleting a message as soon as you've retrieved it. Or you can leave it on the server and let it pile up there. Why might you want to not delete it? Yeah, you might want to check mail from multiple computers, right? And my experience is that probably you want to have one computer that does delete the mail, but probably not for some period of time after it's first received. If you don't have one computer that deletes the mail, then the mail piles up in the mailbox and your ISP gets mad at you for having too much mail. But you can leave the mail on the server. The other thing that having a lot of mail on a POP server does is it makes some of these interactions slow because the list of the mail in the mailbox gets very large. Okay. So text-based protocol. The intended use of POP has always been that you would fetch the mail and delete it. And sort of other styles of usage are maybe abusive of the original intent. On the other hand, IMAP was designed to say, I'm going to keep my mail on the mail, on the mail server in my mailbox, and let's have ways to organize the mail on the mail server in the mailbox. And so there are folders on IMAP servers. You can see the contents of an individual folder. It's pretty nice. It's really intended to support this style of use where you access the mailbox from different locations. IMAP is much better for that. You still do have the issue about when should the mail be deleted from the server. And, you know, do what we can. Okay, now, I want to back up, having talked about that. I want one particular slide here. Okay. Where did it go? Yes. All right. So, the Internet Mail System was really designed around SMTP as its core. And SMTP is all specified in terms of 7-bit ASCII characters. Okay, so no formatting, no pictures, no movies. Can't put those in basic SMTP messages. But of course, people realized that that was a useful thing to do, so people came up with a new standard to let you put those things in messages. And the way it works is using family protocols that come out of what's called the multipurpose Internet Mail Extensions. And what these do are is a sequence of protocol extensions that let you say what kind of thing it is that's in this message. Is it a picture, a movie? What kind of picture? Is it a JPEG picture or a PNG picture? Is it a drawing? Is it HTML? You know, all that stuff is an extension that we do all the time these days to the basic email stuff based on MIME. And what MIME does is it lets you say what's in the message and how is it encoded? Because all those nice 8-bit pixels or 24-bit pixels or something ultimately have to be encoded as 7-bit ASCII characters in order to go through the Internet Mail System. All right? So it's I think this is an interesting story in that we start with something that was, you know, just text-based, and Internet Mail up to the mid-1990s was just text-based. People hadn't really thought about how to do that other stuff yet. Then somebody comes along and says, we've got to be able to send 8-bit characters through, and so there were a bunch of sort of false starts on specifying encodings to send 8-bit characters through, and there were a bunch of different ones. But ultimately, somebody generalized it the community generalized it to MIME, which is now sort of completely open-ended, and you can send anything you want to through email. Okay? Questions? Any comments, Vic? Okay. So, yes, I didn't say anything about security here. Let's rush ahead to the POP protocol, at least. Notice that this is a telnet-based, this is just a protocol you can use telnet for. You're typing in usernames and passwords that are getting sent over the network in clear text. This is a favorite thing of hackers, because if they can get the messages, they can get your username and password. If you've used the password for multiple sites, maybe it's good at other sites that they can't sniff directly. And maybe you're in trouble as a result of this. So modern stuff, and we'll talk about this in the security discussion later in the semester, modern approaches to doing POP and IMAP use encrypted connections over which this kind of stuff may still be being sent, but it's being sent in an encryption wrapper. And so it isn't so obvious how what the values of those things are. Good system administration practice these days turns off the unencrypted POP3 and IMAP protocols. SMTP, on the other hand, is, I believe, still pretty much conducted entirely in the clear. So putting usernames and passwords in email messages is a really bad thing to do. Okay, they float around in the internet, they get stored in mailboxes, they get stored in message queues. You shouldn't do that. Okay. So, email and web are user applications. They're what we know the internet through. The next one we're going to talk about is the domain name service, and this is more of a glue application for the internet. It's something that we sort of see aspects of in our everyday use of the internet, but we don't ever actually interact with it. It's not a user level protocol. It's something that makes the internet go. So here's the issue. Internet protocol addresses are 32-bit numbers, right? And every message that gets sent over the internet is addressed to its destination using a 32-bit number. Now, it would be really, really mentally taxing if, in order to access all the different web servers that we access, we had to know 32-bit, sort of random 32-bit numbers for them, right? Google would be 60.19.37.145, and WSU might be 121.34.17.62. Pardon? And they change from time to time as things move around. It would just be completely a non-starter as far as using the internet. So we needed, early on in the building of the internet, it was recognized that we needed mnemonic names for things. And the names actually, if you think about it a little bit, as you think about a system that has to grow to encompass the world, a hierarchical structure within the names was immediately recognized as a good thing to have. And it turns out that's helpful for people's understanding of names. And it's a good starting point for organizing the implementation of what's called a name service. Okay? So a name service maps names to values. And we're going to say, at least initially, that the values are going to be IP addresses, but we're computer scientists, we generalize it, right? So we'll generalize that very rapidly to encompass other stuff as well. Okay, so DNS was created. One of my former colleagues at Xerox PARC essentially did the initial design of the DNS as his PhD dissertation at UC Berkeley in the early to mid 80s. So domain name system is a distributed database that's okay. So what does the database do? It maps names to values, right? That's what it's got to do. It's distributed and implemented in many, many different name servers. So the overall thing that we're talking about here is a coherent picture of how to do name service, but it's implemented in many different name servers, and there are actually even several different bodies of code that implement the name servers. Again, the importance of protocols to keep that straight. The domain name system operates, as I said, at the application layer, but it's really core internet internal functionality. Okay, so the original purpose was map these things that are called host names to IP addresses, right? But we generalize immediately to allow aliasing, which is a mapping of a name to a different name. So instead of mapping to an address directly, we map it to a different name, which then has to be looked up in a, yeah. Okay, so recursion. That's good. Mail servers. Identification. So when you send mail to WSU.edu address, it's not obvious which server you should be sending it to. So one of the kinds of things that DNS does is it has a special record. Email is so important. It has a special kind of record that says this is the mail server for WSU. Gives its name. And then another trick more recently is to have a name that's sometimes maps to IP address 1, IP address 2. Okay? So some name servers will actually give different answers at different times for the same name. And the purpose of that is load balancing. Why not centralize? So, a lot of these points here boil down to it's important that each organization be able to administer its own namespace. You know, it would be a really difficult proposition if every time WSU wanted to put your computer on its network, it had to send a message to, I don't know, the United Nations or somebody saying, we've got a new computer on our network, its name is this and its address is this. That would just be not good. So another way to say that is that a centralized service for something this big just doesn't scale. So, to make it all work, we leverage the hierarchical forms of names. So, my office computer is has a name that looks like that. If you want to access it, you look up the host name in the EECS DNS service. It's called a domain. In the EECS domain, if you don't know how to look up names in EECS, well, you ask WSU how to look up names in EECS. If you don't know how to look up WSU names, you ask EDU, where WSU is. And if you don't know how to ask about EDU, you ask about dot. You ask dot about EDU. And the things that are dot are what are called the root DNS servers. And the root DNS servers know about these so-called
Let me label them here. The so-called top-level domains.
edu, org, com, net, biz, US, UK, right? Those are all the top-level domains. They're the last thing that can appear in an address, and the root servers have to know all about all of those. Okay? So, here's the story, sort of is the reverse of what I said. And this is the full story. You client query a root server to find out about EDU. Well, we'll do this one instead. About com, ask com about Amazon, ask Amazon about www. Right? So that's the hierarchical nature of the server structure and of the names. Details. We talked about top-level domain servers. Another key aspect is that of an authoritative DNS servers. These can occur at any level. In fact, they do occur at every level. Should say they occur at every level. And they're the servers that are assumed to know the truth about hosts or subdomains within a domain. If other DNS servers have sort of come across knowledge about what exists in a domain, or they may cache that. So this is authoritative versus cached. They may cache that information, but they're not authoritative. If you really want to know the truth, you have to ask an authoritative server. I think we're out of time. There's a little bit more to do with this, and then next time we'll move into chapter 3. No, sorry. Cancel that. Next time, we're going to move into the other book and talk about programming. Right? That's what we're going to do. Boy. Ah.
That was a great speech by Dan Kaminsky, where he did voice over DNS.
Voice over DNS?
Yeah.
Oh,
that scaled pretty well, because, like, you know, if the DNS cached at every level,
uh-huh.
The clients only had to get it, like, from a local DNS server. Like radio or DNS.
Oh, you can abuse this stuff in lots of different ways.
Do you have a copy of the other books as well? Maybe not. I mentioned that might be one of the library.
I think I do. But I'm not even sure where my copy is at the moment.
Okay.
So
maybe I'll check.
I'll check. Okay. Okay, and what was it about?
Basically, it was for converting from kilobits to megabits. To use
I did see that. Yeah, okay. Use decimal numbers. Decimal, yeah.
But for the byte or two base, base two for bytes to kilobytes to megabytes, or do you still use decimal?
In networking, we tend to just use the decimal numbers sort of throughout. So, you know, 8-bit bytes, although I'm not terribly averse to rounding to 10, but 8-bit bytes, but beyond that, decimal. Okay. Ah. Hi. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah. I do need your picture.
Yeah, I realized that when you sent it. I completely spaced on that.
Okay.
I'll send it.
Okay, you feeling better?
Yeah, I love my potatoes.
That's worth something, too.
hiding myself for 4 days. I knew I was contagious. I didn't want someone to think like
this. Thank you.
It's going around pretty hard. Yeah. And even so, I still like trying to get into my bathroom mate because I'm coughing pretty bad. Like, I didn't like choose to see him for sure about him, so.
No, it's just only have one left. I thought I needed to save my life, but I guess I don't want to have one. So I'm okay.
Cool, bro. Cool.
Thanks, though. It was appreciated. I just messaged you and you did alright.
Alright,
I know we're out of time.